me. But when you finally kind of work up the courage to say what you feel and have people actually listen and not write you off, and a very large amount of people, you felt, I mean, your voice almost started shaking, not out of fear, but out of like just excitement, you know? And it's like, then you get down off the, remember the soapbox? God, that was wonderful. But you get down off the soapbox and your legs would kind of be shaky and you're just, so, and your adrenaline was through the roof and you felt just good because your voice was finally heard. And not by, you know, your friends who are maybe sick of hearing it from you, but by people who care and who do want to make a difference. And, you know, and you actually felt that you made a difference, and it was great. It was great to watch.
You know, for me, anarchism, and it's a word, it's a concept, and the word itself, you could throw it out. You know,
Yep, absolutely.
it's not important, especially if it's going to cause such a reaction. But for me, anarchism is about feeling like I am the most powerful thing in my world, that I have the power to change my life. And in that, in having the power to change my life, I also have the power to change other people's lives for the better as well.
Right, and just the idea that you have control of your own fate and you can inspire people to do the same. Yeah.
Cool. Well, this has been Occupy Wall Street Radio. Once again, I'm your host, Luke Richardson.
And I'm Bo Sibbing.
Have a great night. We'll see you again tomorrow. You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
You made that right.
Don't want you tell everyone what the right to do. Film the police when I take for the underclass. Get the face, name, and number on the badge. They flash, we flash back when they act disorderly. React accordingly and capture order we see. Nightsticks, zip ties, and tasers. Think your license for tight, vicious behavior. Make a tight miss with the video trends. Or the pig like this, he dripping, you make him blame us. Explain to a judge the bounds you overstepping. 2011, time to change our method. We aiming lenses at the state's weapon. Today, remember whose goddamn streets they're protecting. Yeah, they rather see me in a cell than me in my cell with a different story to tell. Can't pull up out of dash next time you get stopped. Reach for the cell. If you wanna shoot a cop on a public sidewalk, you could take what you see. A film from your window with the view of the street. Neighborhood crime watch, we police the police. They can't arrest the whole community because the streets clock these cops. Occupied blocks, harassing the homeless and batons and pulling glocks. They stop lawful protests and let off shots. Abuse prostitutes and misuse power they got. In memory of the victims who were never forgot. We gotta exercise our right to shed light in the dark. There is an army on the march.
Something inside is so strong.
Billionaire class and their congressional stooges want to close nearly half of the post office mail processing centers nationwide, eliminate 4,000 post offices and Saturday service, and fire over 200,000 workers. In New York City alone, as many as 34 post offices may be eliminated. This is a congressionally manufactured crisis caused by imposing onerous financial mandates on the post office. Wall Street wants the postal system sold off to corporate vultures. Don't let them. Join with Community Labor United for Postal Jobs and Services. Assemble at Union Square Saturday, March 17, 12 noon. Then march to the Manhattan General Post Office at 33rd Street and 8th Avenue for a rally at 2 p.m. to save the post office and postal workers' jobs.
On Saturday, March 24th at 2 p.m., the Brooklyn Adlib Theater Company, in conjunction with the WBAI Advisory Board, will present William Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1. It will be held at the Hudson Park Library at 66 Leroy Street in Manhattan. It is free and open to the public.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock. Time, once again, for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't.
much worse. But if they could, they would. Oh, Lily Bomb for the best, just beg the worst. I hope that's understood. But Lily, no!
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Mike.
Hello and happy Pi Day.
Okay, we're going to talk about that, Mike. Dot Ret.
Happy Pi Day.
All right, is everybody going to say the same thing? Rob T. Firefly.
Happy 7 over 22 day.
Uh-huh, and,
22 over 7.
And welcome Kyle as well.
Hey, what's going on?
See, that's a normal greeting. That's what I expect from people. And Bernie S. down in Philadelphia.
Actually, I'm in northeastern Pennsylvania, but I am enjoying pie.
Okay, that's great. I hear they have very good pie in that part of the state. And every week you're in a different part of Pennsylvania, it seems, to sort of maybe taking a tour of the state, which is great.
I get around.
Uh-huh. Cell phone or landline today?
I'm on a landline, which is probably apparent to you and our listeners.
Doesn't he sound much better?
Yeah,
much
you sound better. Fantastic.
Yeah, he really does. He should be on the landline all the time, I think.
Okay, we'll work on that.
Oh, I mean, you should be in person, too. I'm not saying just stay on the phone. But,
okay,
yeah.
I get the message.
All right. Because cell phones really sound awful. I mean, that's sort of what we say here on week after
well,
week.
They do that on purpose.
Uh-huh. There's been no progress in the cell phone.
Well, they try to squeeze as much bandwidth. They try to squeeze us with giving us as little bandwidth as possible. And so when your voice is squeezed into like a 3 kilobit per second stream over the wireless system, that's why you have crappy cell phone calls.
And we pay for that pleasure.
Yeah.
We certainly do. We certainly do. Anything exciting happening in our lives this week that anybody wants to touch upon? No? Routine? Nothing?
I live only for the radio program. Well, I just go into hiding for the other 167 hours.
We might as well go into the Pi Day thing. We want to explain it to the folks that might be uninitiated.
Today is March 14th, which is 314 in the U.S. way of reckoning, which is the first few digits of Pi.
Okay. Do you know when Mario Day is?
Mario?
Yes.
No, I don't.
Kyle, maybe you could explain.
Well, on the 10th of March, which can be abbreviated with three letters, M-A-R, and with the 1 and 0 for the day.
Looks like Mario.
If you squint your eyes, you could say that it's Mario. So.
And if you're into the video game from way back, it's kind of a cool thing to say.
If we should save that until that's on a Wednesday. And we're giving our listeners old news.
That's true.
And if you get a pizza with a radius of Z and a depth of A, then the volume of it is pi ZZA.
Okay. Speaking of marking your calendars, here's something that we got from our friends over at Verizon. March 22nd, communities all across the United States, people belonging to CWA, transport workers union members, Jobs with Justice, AFL-CIO activists, and lots of supporters will be holding rallies and actions to spotlight the corporate greed of what they call very greedy Verizon. I don't know how to pronounce that. V-E-R-I, followed by greedy.
Very greedy.
Fine, yeah.
Very greedy.
But the I is, it's a long I, so maybe I should say very greedy.
Remember when we didn't know it was a long I?
Very greedy.
Yeah, and in New York, in joint action, CWA and TWU members will protest Verizon's corporate greed and join the fair contract fight of TWU members at the Metropolitan Transit Authority. Not quite sure how that's going to happen. They're going to be riding all the subways and buses and things like that. Bernie, have you heard anything more about this?
I wouldn't say I've heard more about it, but I have heard about it. And, there's a lot of good people that work for the phone company, and it's the phone company, not the employees, that we generally have problems with. So, I'd like to support these phone company workers.
Okay, well, how can we do that? Not make phone calls that day? Or
you know, that would be really interesting. You know how workers would, like, form a picket line to keep people from going in to do business with some company?
Right.
You know, how could you do that if you're working for the phone company?
You know, E, I got a suggestion. Why don't people call headquarters, right? Call Verizon headquarters and speak to them about it.
You know what? I think this is something. Okay, I want to get into this because, Kyle, you've been involved with a lot of phone calls lately. I'm going to get into that in a moment.
Okay, all right.
But one of the people I know you've been calling for various reasons is Verizon corporate headquarters.
Yeah.
Here in New York City.
Well, yeah, the New York headquarters. Actually, Verizon is headquartered in New York.
Okay, so what we're going to do now, we're going to try and call them. And this is, keep in mind, this is Verizon, a huge phone company. Huge phone company. You don't know the number? I know what it ends in. If you knew the exchange.
I think it's 795.
No, I think it's 394. Wasn't it their address? Or 375, maybe. Okay, we don't know the phone number. do you have something to look it up with?
Yeah, I'll check it.
Okay, we're going to call them. And you might be surprised at what you hear when you try calling the main switchboard of Verizon. And think back to the old days.
Why do you want to talk to them?
Well, exactly. There's all kinds of messages you want to convey to them sometimes. And if you know our history, you know that we've had lots of dealings with Verizon. And sometimes you just want to talk to a human being. It does happen.
Well, I can comment that I actually spent some time calling around to other phone numbers because I was having trouble getting a hold of the headquarters. And it was amazing to sit on the phone for like an hour with someone who works for the company. And they came back and they tried all these different methods. And they said, no, I don't have a way. I don't have a way to contact headquarters. And I just remarked to the person, I was like, you know, that's amazing. I mean, for me, it's sort of amazing. A telephone company doesn't have a phone number that you can actually dial into and contact corporate headquarters. But as an employee of a company like that, that's got to be distressing. Like, you work for this big organization, and if you ever wanted to talk to someone in the administrative end, you have absolutely no way of contacting them. So I remarked, and that was a part of my experience in finding it. But it's good to hear that, you know, the communication workers are finding other ways to have their, you know, corporate entity behind their employment understand their plight.
Okay, this dial tone is the dial tone we're going to use to get a hold of Verizon. Let's call them right now. Corporate headquarters.
And we are handing their phone numbers out over the air.
Okay, here we go.
Verizon Center.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
This is it. One single mailbox.
Yeah.
But the entire corporation.
Yeah, and it went straight to voicemail, so I think
there
are
a way. Beep. There's no beep.
We could just talk.
Are we recording now?
Well, let's just have the show without hanging. Just don't
I don't want to fill up Verizon's mailbox. That could easily happen. I'm going to hit a star just in case. Because
message erased.
Oh, see?
At the tone, please re-record.
I'm
going to
hit a pound sign.
Message.
Oh, let me hit another pound sign.
If you are satisfied with your
star.
Message,
I am
press
not.
1. To listen to your message, press 2. To erase message review.
Let me hit another pound sign.
If you are satisfied with your message, press 1. To listen to your message, press 2. To erase and re-record, press 3. To continue recording where you left off, press 4.
I'm going to hit star and see what happens.
You have reached Verizon's voice messaging service. To leave a message, please enter the area code and telephone number of the person you are calling. If you have a mailbox on this system, please press pound.
Okay.
Mailbox number, please.
And then you enter the mailbox, and you could basically log into anybody's account, including Verizon's main switchboard number. You just would expect more from corporate headquarters than a simple Verizon voice mailbox that every consumer has to start with.
Right.
So I was amazed when you showed me this. And,
yeah,
it's, you know, back in the old days, you would reach a switchboard with massive amounts of people, and you could be switched all over the place, and there'd be operators, real people. You get the sense nobody really cares anymore.
You know what that really reminds me of is like when people start these companies where they just have it like registered somewhere to like some PO box that they, it's almost like an absentee running of sorts. It just feels almost like that. Like there's no one actually there.
I'm just impressed that Verizon is, as they say, eating their own dog food. They're using their own service. This is the service that you can buy from Verizon, and they're saying it's good enough for us too.
That's, if that's not an endorsement, I don't know what it is.
Well, I'm sure I'm not going to use it, because I'd rather have an answering machine with a 3-digit code than have one of their services.
Well, to be honest, they this is just really the way they like it. They like making it hard to actually get in touch with them. Many large companies, it's very, very, very hard.
Right, but a telephone company? Come on. I mean, they've got to have an operator. They've got to have...
The telephone company.
Yeah, sorry, the telephone company. But and I've found it's actually... They're actually rare in the fact that it's just going straight to this weird voicemail. A lot of companies, as you said, I've been calling around to different companies for other reasons, but it's actually very common if you don't have someone at the company that you're looking for specifically, they'll just simply deny you. So if you do get a hold of a modern, quote, switchboard operator at a corporation of some kind, you have to have a contact there, or they won't refer you to anyone. You can go through the directories by last name, but you have to know parts of the last name to even get their extension, which is common. I mean, we've sort of expected that, and it's been done for quite some time. But
yeah, nothing I'm really that surprised by.
What does it take? A little more research on their website, then you call back, and you have the name, and you get in anyway. So it's interesting.
Bernie, I wanted to touch upon this story that you forwarded to our list concerning Twitter and somebody who was charged with transmitting threats over the internet. We're talking about Justin J. Verneau of Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. He was charged with transmitting threats over the internet, according to United States District Attorney Zane David Memminger. The indictment charges that Verneau used Twitter to send threats to kill and rape a woman and to kill the woman's son. Not very nice things here. If convicted, the defendant faces a maximum possible sentence of 25 years in prison, a $1.25 million fine, and a special assessment of $500, which seems kind of bizarre. Now, what's interesting here, and the reason we're bringing this up, is it's somehow different when Twitter is involved than when something happens in real life. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there's all these you know, federal laws are all surrounded around you know, the Constitution's allowing Congress to pass laws that where there's an interstate trade nexus, and anything involving the telephone system, the federal government says, well, that goes across state lines. So therefore, so does the internet. So therefore, it becomes a federal crime. So if you know, if I walked up to you on the street in New York and said, "I want to kill you," or "I want you dead," or something like that, as opposed to me sending you a tweet saying that, I could face serious federal charges and additional charges for using interstate telephone lines or the internet to threaten you. So it's like a great multiplier. If this was just a person-to-person thing, the local police probably would have just been involved, and it would have been just like a state or local offense handled by local cops. There would have been little or no enforcement or prosecution action, or maybe you got charged with a misdemeanor for terroristic threats or something. But now it becomes like this multi-year sentence he's looking at for using Twitter to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to suggest that they're being a bit overzealous when someone says something horrible like that. But what you raise a very good point, because people are always threatening to kill each other in the street and in person and things like that. But I think maybe the difference is that if you walk up to somebody in the street and say that, it's really their word against yours. What if, for instance, you were to send them a letter expressing your desire to end their life, and that letter was presented as evidence? Would the penalty then be the same?
Well, it would be different charges, but yeah, it would involve. It could then bring in the feds, because you use the mails, which then it would be a harassment by communications using a federal mail facility kind of thing. So it would be a slightly different federal offense than if you'd used the. Use the Twitterverse, but it would still bring in the feds.
You just said really... Twitterverse, Bernie? Really? You just said that?
I did, I know.
You were the last one. You were the last person in the studio not to use that word. Oh, boy. Okay. This is a dark day in the history of Off the Hook.
It seems like there should be some parity, and I'm not at all defending this defendant's actions if he really did them. But in any case, I don't think the punishment should be like you know, 10 times greater if you use internet or a telephone line, or than if you just did it face-to-face.
Right. That's the trouble with civil liberties issues. You have to defend people that you find to be horrible people, but it's in the interest of society because you don't want rights to be taken away because, you know, the rights will be taken away to basically even things out with these crazy charges that can now happen if you say something over Twitter. Well, okay, in person then, if you threaten somebody 25 years in jail now or something like that.
Well, first of all, I think I had today's date in the when will Bernie say Twitterverse pool, so I'll expect everything after that.
Yeah, we'll talk
after. But seriously though, if they're going to be prosecuting people on this level for saying things that terrible online, I mean, I think that shuts down the comments on any YouTube videos and news articles and pretty much everything else that's ever been posted to the internet because everything gets one of those comments.
Now, I'm hearing a lot of this have to do with the fact that it's supposed to be an interstate medium, therefore bringing in the feds because of that. And Bernie mentioned, for instance, that if it was mail, chances are you'd have the same sort of issue. So can we test that this is the actual reason that they're trying to charge us more heavily and, say, have people yell across, like physically across state borders, have an argument there and see if that brings in the feds or if this is just a... some prosecution of a new medium that the law is just somewhat vague on, such as the internet.
One thing we can certainly say is that this is not something that mainstream media will focus on, because why would they? Why would they care about a story like this? But if you look at it carefully, it's significant, and it could be a step in a very bad direction if this is to become the norm. Here's something else that actually is a disturbing step, too, something we've seen in the past. This is the case of Richard O'Dwyer, who was an ex-administrator of a video linking website known as TV Shack, that was based in the United Kingdom. He will be getting a free trip to the United States to face copyright infringement charges, otherwise known as being extradited. Despite public outrage, Home Secretary Theresa May approved the extradition order, and the 23-year-old student has never even been to the United States, but now faces several years in a U.S. prison. This is for downloading programs or content or alleged copyrighted material. And it's just incredible. Can you imagine if United States citizens were subjected to the same thing? If, say, Tanzania decided that something that we posted was illegal in their eyes, we could wind up in a Tanzanian jail for, I'm not picking on them for any particular reason, but I'm just saying it's a bizarre thing to expect. And for some reason, we think we can do this. We being the United States, our government seems to think they can get away with this. And they are getting away with it. That's the thing that really gets me. How do they get away with this?
Yeah, I was just going to say, they don't think they can get away with it. They can get away with it. They do get away with it. And they ruin people's lives.
Uh-huh. Meantime, somebody in Afghanistan goes crazy, one of our soldiers, and kills a bunch of innocent people. His name is protected. He's nice and anonymous in some hidden place. We'll never see justice in an Afghan court. But if somebody downloads something we don't like in any country, we can bring them here and lock them up in our prisons. Doesn't make sense.
Well, the reason this country does it is simply because they can do it, but it's outrageous.
Well, why can they do it? What, might makes right? Is that what we're dealing with
basically,
here?
Basically, but if you think, like, seriously, that's all it seems to come
well,
down
China's
to.
China's got a lot of might, you know.
Well,
can we expect
States,
to be visiting China soon if we offend
might,
them?
Need to be careful with the precedents they set. But anyway, it is a strange and silly thing to do because this person is being prosecuted for the laws of a country that he takes no part in otherwise. Like, you know, just talking about the internet. Everyone can't worry about the laws that they possibly could be breaking of foreign countries all over the place. There's nearly 200 countries around the world. There's no way to be aware of every single law of every single country.
And this guy's crime, Richard O'Dwyer's crime, was operating TV Shack, a website that carried links to copyrighted TV shows. He didn't have the TV shows on his site. He had links to the TV shows. And you know what? These are TV shows that are on free television to start with. So if you dare to do that, and the reason is they want to control in Europe and the United Kingdom and Asia, they want to control it so that you can't watch American TV programs until they decide you're ready to see that. Whereas here we have Hulu and we have TV.com. We can see them anytime. That's all this guy was doing, was making it so that people in the United Kingdom, for some reason, can watch American Idol and all the garbage we have on in this country. I mean, yeah, that's a crime of a different nature, but he really apparently pissed off the powers that be here. And, you know what, this is something I think we need to follow and support this guy, because there are going to be so many others just like him.
Well, it's advertising dollars, and the way that it's put forth anyway.
How does it hurt them?
Well,
they don't see our commercials in England for used car dealers in New York. It doesn't hurt advertising.
Many of the companies that do make it on air are international companies and probably wouldn't be hurt by it. However, the products they sell might not be the same in every country. Not every company that that puts out a commercial for a given show in a given region has an audience abroad, and they view it as every time a show is aired that they're technically paying for the show to be put on. This is how these
shows
make
money. Yeah, but this is somebody who wouldn't have seen the show in the first place.
So
if anything, the advertisers in the United Kingdom, their commercials aren't being seen because he's watching American television instead. It's ridiculous.
I think you're making a huge mistake here, which is assuming that their reasons make sense either from a financial perspective or just in general. What they're doing is they're asserting control for the sake of asserting control, and they can get away with it.
All right. Well, Julia O'Dwyer, Richard's mother, severely disappointed with the decision, says her son has been sold to the U.S. The extradition may disrupt his life for years. It's controversial because under certain circumstances, merely linking the copyright material isn't an offense in the United Kingdom. Get that. It's not even an offense in the country he lives in. But because the U.K. government has not introduced the much-needed changes to the extradition law, it's insane. We're going to be following this, obviously.
This has come up in some other cases we've talked about on this program, that there's this huge imbalance in the extradition treaty, where it's much easier for people to be extradited from the United Kingdom to the United States than the other way around, particularly in cases like this, where the person was in the United Kingdom the whole time and did something that does not violate United Kingdom law. Somehow it's still possible for them to be extradited to the United States, and yet not the other way around.
And the real irony here, a couple of weeks ago we reported on some tourists who were from the United Kingdom wanting to visit the United States, who were denied entry to the United States because one of them had tweeted that he intended to dig up the grave of Marilyn Monroe, and Homeland Security took that seriously. So people who want to come here can't, but people who don't want to come here are forced to.
I can't keep all these cases straight in my head anymore very easily, but was this website TVShack a .com website?
Oh, you're going to try to get me to admit that I went to it? Well, I'm not going to do that.
I
don't know anything about it.
You know, you have the papers there, so why I'm asking you. The reason being that there's the logic of that if it's a .com, .net, .org, that it's being routed through U.S. servers and thus is in part a crime on U.S.
I'll look it up. I've heard that. That's something that came out this week, that if it's a .com, the United States can do whatever they want to the people that registered it. And
so
it's,
beware, if that's
yeah.
The linking thing historically in this country has been sort of laughable, and I think it's notwithstanding, that I think is a whole other attribute to this. But the fact, like you mentioned, to speak to that, that people, they should be happy that more eyeballs are seeing their content. Perhaps, I guess we can hope, or that, you know, precedents like this will affect some change in the way these advertising deals are brokered, because they're basically cutting themselves off to a huge market anyway. Seems like they're dealing with old contracts as far as advertising and stuff that don't really speak to a much broader distribution base now. I mean,
I'm seeing TVShack.bz. I don't know where that is, it's definitely not. It could be. It's not the United States, that's for sure.
But there is on the flip side of this, there is a network called NRK Beta, which is a network from Norway, which puts up torrents and online videos of their own content, because they released a long statement basically being one of the entities who gets it. They basically came down to it and said the only way to control your content anymore in today's online atmosphere is to be the best provider of it. If people want torrents of your stuff, give them torrents. If people want it on YouTube, give it to them on YouTube, or give them an equivalent experience, because people are going to have that whether it's you giving it to them or not. And so if it is you giving it to them, you still maintain that control, and you can do what you want with the medium, because it's yours.
Interesting. Okay, and we also want to talk about the story of Aaron Bond. This is a 14-year-old kid who was Europe's youngest app designer, computer whiz kid. He was crowned the youngest app designer in Europe, and he's been expelled after hacking into his school's computer system. That's right. He used his skills to access confidential information about staff and students, even looking up the vice principal's financial information, which for some reason was on that computer. Using passwords, he managed to look at details about his peers, was able to edit the IT room booking system, oh, heaven forbid, and school newsletter before the security breach was spotted. He's now been visited by police, who took DNA samples and fingerprints before giving him a formal reprimand. His school, King Edward VI College in Totnay, which is in Devon, which is somewhere in the UK, has permanently expelled him and maintains no student should have had access to passwords. But they aren't dealing with the actual issue as to why it was so easy to get in and why there in the first place. Now, he has designed 6 apps used on smartphones. He is the managing director of his own web design company. He was among handpicked delegates at the Apple conference last year. He's already being considered for university courses because he's so advanced with computers. He said he was curious about whether he could hack the school's system. He claims he infiltrated the computers after seeing a list of passwords displayed on a whiteboard in the school's IT room, but the school insists no one within the school would have had access to them. That whiteboard apparently was not for his eyes, and they should have been restricted. Even after the breach was spotted and the system locked down, he was still able to get into the vice principal's financial records. He said, "I was a bit scared and curious, and I wondered if I would be able to get in again." You know, what did this kid do wrong? Does anybody see anything bad about basically?
Go ahead. I'll tell you what he did wrong. He wrote the whole paragraph like a press release. Who told him he's the youngest?
Well, he didn't write this. I'm reading a news story.
Well, someone told him from the
Telegraph.
But as far as
do you know of an 8-year-old that is writing
it? How would we know?
There could be, but I don't think there is because the Telegraph wouldn't lie.
Yeah, they would.
Let's not make this about the Telegraph. Let's make it about the story.
Anyway, but the story is silly. It's not clear why he should be expelled for this.
The United Kingdom knows a thing or two about who they crown and stuff like that.
Well, maybe he'll be extradited now because maybe one of those passwords belonged to the United States. Who knows?
But evidently in the United Kingdom they haven't seen the film War Games from like 25 years ago because that's exactly how the kid in that movie did it.
True.
And they haven't learned. They haven't learned how to keep things secure. They should be happy that they have somebody who's there to test their security and not do something malicious. Because, you know, if this kid wasn't around, they'd still have the same security holes and someone malicious would come along and do the same thing. So
is this this black whiteboard, is it in the IT room whose booking system
he changed?
It
was a whiteboard with passwords written on it so anybody could read them. And, you know, apparently everyone was supposed to just ignore that.
I think that the school should open an investigation into the vice principal for storing his personal financial data on school equipment.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. For some reason, all of our news is coming out of the UK this week, but BBC News outlet BBC Persia was reportedly hacked by Iranian authorities. I believe this was a couple of evenings ago. The news group claims that the cyber attack is part of an expanding effort by the regime to stifle coverage within the country. I'm not sure what news group they're referring to, but this is a story that we saw on Gizmodo, actually. BBC's Director General Mark Thompson reported that BBC's London office was inundated with robocalls and also that a group had attempted to jam the company's satellite feeds into Iran. The jamming would only affect owners of illegal satellite dishes, which, not coincidentally, are the only ones that can receive the BBC signal in the first place. Interesting. But hackers are being blamed again for this, even if it was something government-sanctioned.
Well, I find that just fascinating, because if the government is actually behind, it seems very silly, almost as if like they're trying to isolate themselves. Because if BBC Persia is operating legally, they can use whatever legal means they want to say what a news organization is allowed to broadcast in their country. They don't need to break into the systems and... it just seems strange.
Well, according to the official statement, there was a day recently when there was a simultaneous attempt to jam 2 different satellite feeds of BBC Persian into Iran to disrupt the service's London phone lines by the use of multiple automatic calls and a sophisticated cyber attack on the BBC. It is difficult and may prove impossible to confirm the source of these attacks. Though attempted jamming of BBC services into Iran is nothing new, and we regard the coincidence of these different attacks as self-evidently suspicious.
Now, that actually brings up the point that I want to make, is if there's really no way to know for sure who did it, it does seem very strange, the nature of these attacks. How do we know that it's really not someone else just trying to make you know, this one of the most complicated things of having this whole cyber warfare thing and big and countries involved is who's to say who's actually doing an attack when one person can start an attack and make it look like, you know, thousands of computers from a different country are taking part. It's
a form of spoofing.
Well, there's a long history of various countries trying to jam other countries' news broadcasts,
exactly.
Mostly throughout the Cold War. It's decreased a bit, but I'm sure Iran is, you know, still got some of their best satellite jammers still jamming out. But now they've moved online. It's sort of interesting, but probably not new.
Yeah, but you know, if you wanted to really cast aspersions over Iran, what better way to do it than to engineer something like this? If you want to be all conspiratorial about it,
all I'm trying to say is that if this company, like I'm not 100% familiar on the status of BBC Persia, but if it is, you know, operating as legal, you know, not really ruffling anyone's feathers too much, then it just seems strange that the Iranian authorities, I'm sorry, wouldn't use more official means to control as they do with everything else. You know, why would they need to use subversive methods so overtly?
Have you seen how our own government treats people doing perfectly legal things that they don't like?
Yeah, but normally they would throw paper at them first and then, you know, force them if they don't listen.
I mean, I don't know for sure, but I imagine that the BBC Persian Language Service is operating in accordance with British law, but perhaps not so much with Iranian law, which may be the conflict here.
Well, if it's operating in the UK, it seems very simple to simply block web access there unless they're illegally, you know, pirate radio and other sorts of things have going on in that country. That'd be a completely different issue.
Well, we have our own way of of blocking signals from other countries, simply not carrying them on cable systems or satellite systems. Try watching Al Jazeera. It's very hard to do. I mean, obviously you can do it online, but not everybody has that kind of access. Not everybody has that kind of bandwidth.
Emmanuel, that's not at all the same thing.
Oh, it's not?
No, it's not at all.
Well, people wind up not seeing foreign perspectives.
I mean, look, it's a shame, but it's not at all the same thing as actively blocking it.
Well, the result is the same, well, I think. If you convince people that they're getting all the news that's out there and they're not, I think that's a lot more effective than people knowing that the news they want to get is being blocked. I think they at least know that there's something else out there.
Well, that's also, you know, culturally, if you think about it, the United States doesn't really have much experience with, say, foreign nations broadcasting pirate radio stations, ex-countries free so and such a radio in the United States.
Emmanuel.
Go ahead, Barney.
Maybe there's a better analogy in that case that happened, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, where I think it was a gentleman from Brooklyn who was, or somewhere, one of the boroughs, was making satellite television programming available to people in the U.S. from the programmer Al Manar, which was the TV channel, I believe, of Hezbollah. Hezbollah had been named by the U.S. as a terrorist organization, and simply providing the video programming from Hezbollah, Al Manar, to U.S. residents, this individual was charged federally with providing material support to a terrorist organization, and is currently in federal prison, where he's been for several years. So
right, just by giving people access to some other perspective of the news, this guy is in prison in this country. So yeah, it does happen.
Yeah, Bernie is right. That's actually
all right. So let's turn things more domestic, because we have spent an inordinate amount of time in the UK tonight. And then we have some other updates as well. We'll be taking phone calls in just a few minutes in addition. The Occupy Wall Street protesters are starting to be in the news again, or continuing to be in the news. Kira Moya Sims is someone who is standing by the Manhattan Bridge buying coffee while three of her friends waited nearby in a car. And what?
That's all she does all day. She stands by the Manhattan Bridge.
Are you
going
to argue with everything I say today?
Yeah,
I'm just saying she's buying coffee by the Manhattan Bridge.
Right now?
We only are on for an hour. Yes, she was buying coffee while her friends waited nearby in a car. If you want to interrogate her about this, well, we can find her contact info. Anyway, more than a dozen blocks away, protesters were gathering for an Occupy Wall Street day of action. which organizers had described as an attempt to block the streets around the New York Stock Exchange. Then, Ms. Moya Sims said about 30 police officers surrounded her and the people in the car. All four were arrested and taken to a police facility in the East Village. Officers strip-searched them, ignored their request for a lawyer. The fourth person couldn't be reached for comment, but this is according to three of the four anyway. Now, Ms. Moya Sims, 20 years old, said members of the police department's intelligence division asked about her personal history, her relationship with other protesters, the nature of Occupy Wall Street, plans for upcoming protests. She said, "I felt like I had been arrested for a thought crime." They're preparing to sue the city, adding that the arrest had violated their constitutional rights. Not only are the police disrupting people's rights to free expression, one of her lawyers says, they are taking preemptive steps by arresting people who might be just thinking about exercising their rights. Now, according to the story from the New York Times, Occupy Wall Street has largely faded from the headlines, but organizers are planning springtime demonstrations in an effort to revitalize their movement. And they're troubled by what they consider continued monitoring by the police. And this continues in other stories as well. Prosecutors have subpoenaed the Twitter records of an arrested Occupy Wall Street protester, seeking his account information and tweets that he sent around the time of his arrest last fall. Jeff Ray, 31 years old, was arrested during a mass protest on the Brooklyn Bridge in October. He posted the subpoena on his Twitter account on Monday. The subpoena seeks all of Ray's tweets from September 15th, 2 days before the Occupy movement began in downtown Manhattan, through October 31st, along with account and contact info. And the subpoena is dated March 8th. What I don't get is they can simply scroll down on Twitter themselves and get at least the tweets and the account information. You know, you don't really have to give truthful information on Twitter to start with. And obviously they know who he is. I don't understand these Twitter subpoenas. What is it they're after?
You seem to assume that there's someone smart enough at the attorney's office to scroll down on Twitter. And
I assume they are somewhat smart, Mike. I do. I'm trying to figure out how they're thinking. What is it they're actually doing? Is this a chilling effect? Is this something that they just want to intimidate everybody?
So part of it's probably intimidation. Part of it is that if you want to use this stuff in court, then it helps to say we got this officially from Twitter itself rather than just, hey, we were looking on the internet and look what we found.
Mm-hmm.
But largely it's they don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to combat activism on the internet, which they very much want to do. And so they try silly things like subpoenaing Twitter because Twitter has an office that's in San Francisco and you can send it letters.
Or maybe Twitter is just one of the many organizations they're subpoenaing. And this is the only one we found out about. And actually, they're doing a very good job of getting every single computer system this guy attaches to and finding out a lot more about him.
And it really goes to show their understanding of the internet in general. The fact that they're arresting people and then interrogating them, asking them about what is Occupy Wall Street planning? Because, you know, if they knew about this internet thing that was out there, they would know that that's where everything that Occupy Wall Street is doing is constantly announced. You know, they're not really doing things behind any closed doors, I don't think.
Considering that 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people is a narc to start with, somebody who will testify against his friends. We talked about this last week. We talked about this many, many times at the Hope Conference. Well, considering that, it shouldn't be too hard for them to find somebody that will help them a lot more than they apparently are trying to do this themselves. So I don't know. It's fun to watch to see what it is they're up to next, and we have to remain vigilant. One thing we can learn from all this, it's got their attention, and they're really kind of afraid of what's going to happen next. And you have to ask yourself why. Why is something that's healthy, expressing yourself in the streets, demonstrating, being somewhat raucous, and just getting word out about different opinions, why is that such a threat in supposedly an open society?
Well, if this somewhat arbitrary number of about a quarter of everyone is a narc that's been getting thrown around lately is true.
Potential.
Well, you know, we haven't seen any citation. This is just some number that, you know, at some point in the past we started throwing around.
We made it up. We pretty much made that up, yes.
Let's just stick with a quarter. Let's say that actually that's how many people are really narking, just anywhere you look. You know, as we spoke about last week, this is the process by which they turn people into narcs. You know, just because, you know, you say, well, they have all these people that are You know, ratting at everyone else. Why do they need to do this? Well, this is how it's done. You know, the stuff is out in the open, but they don't necessarily understand it. You know, it's very easy to find this information. You know where to look. But if they don't know, they find other people that will talk to them, and they do it with intimidation.
Right. It's like what we were speaking to last week with the searches at the stations. It's like police phishing, in this case, phishing for people who potentially could be involved and then turned in the future.
And the funny thing is, if they pulled me, like me, for example, out of Zuccotti Park, arrested me and demanded to know everything I know about Occupy Wall Street, all they would have to be doing is following the same Twitter accounts I follow, and they would know all I know, pretty much.
Yeah, it's more fun to follow people, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
All right, some updates. As we've mentioned in the past, we just were referring to the Hope Conference last, the last Hope Conference, which was actually the next Hope, took place in 2010. Well, the next one, Hope Number 9, takes place July 13, 14, and 15, 2012, Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. And a lot has been going on. We've been busy at work behind the scenes getting everything lined up. We're doing site inspections and talking to all kinds of new people. It's really growing. It's something that is it's really fun to watch. Our ninth conference, the amount of changes that have been undertaken over the years is simply phenomenal. And I know, Carl, you've been heavily involved in talking to people about specifically network gear, some of the advancements we might be making this year, and things we've learned from the Europeans and from other conferences as well. What are some of the things that we might be able to look forward to?
Yeah, I guess in the spirit of what we've done as far as putting things together, we've sort of built component pieces of whatever we had around us. And this year, based on some of that inspiration from seeing other events, seeing it work really well, and a lot of really interesting technology being used by hackers, by people that understand the technology, we're sort of opening it up, which is sort of new territory in general. But we basically wanted to invite people that actually make some of this equipment to contribute in a technical way to the network that we're building. And so I've reached out and helped the network team communicate with some of the organizations that build sort of the latest technology out there to run this demonstration ISP. And we're talking to a lot of different organizations to try to build those component pieces into a really amazing internal network. And definitely, we've had amazing stuff in the past. We basically are building upon that and bringing in the actual manufacturers' gear so they can demonstrate and we can show like what we can really create.
You were telling me before just some. I guess statistics or speeds, or it was just going way over my head. But give me a sense as to what it's been in the past, what it is over in Europe, what we can possibly look forward to, what we can dream about as far as just what a network can be.
Yeah, the technology actually moves very, very quickly, as I'm sure people imagine. In the past, we've had like 10/100 speeds, which are typical. I mean, that's been around for quite a while.
What does that mean to somebody just listening at
like,
home?
Like, yeah, 10 megabits and 100 megabits, depending on what the speeds of are the base of the connect of the network interface cards and the switches involved.
Okay.
And 10/100 has been around for quite some time now. It's a pretty standard Ethernet standard. And basically with some of the gear that we've had in the past, that's been the top end of our network speed. And one thing I saw that was just sort of common in a lot of the other events around the world was gigabit speed. So, I want to make a gigabit speed sort of our baseline, our slowest speed. And then for some of the other parts of the internal network, I'd like to see some of the other standards being incorporated in the backbone and other things like that.
Now, we've been to Germany, we've been to the Chaos Congress and the camp and various other events over there. And they like to show off the speed that they have. They say things like, use more bandwidth. You're not using enough bandwidth. We have more bandwidth going into this building than the entire continent of Africa, which, you know, I think is kind of nasty, but it's true. And it's something that I think we here in New York City, it should be something that's a no-brainer. But it is more of a challenge than people might think. What are some of the challenges that are being faced?
You're absolutely right. I wouldn't say they're cavalier about it, but they're definitely, you know.
They like to rub it in our faces, I think.
I And that honestly made me redouble, and that's exactly why I'm so excited about what we're putting together. And as we build it out, more people are getting excited and wanting to contribute and share ideas on how to design it and stuff like that. Because I realized that, you know, these amazing networks they're building are using equipment that's designed, manufactured, and sold here in the U.S. Basically, a lot of these companies are headquartered here. A lot of the innovation takes place here. And I just knew it. I knew if we put the right momentum behind it, we could absolutely do it. That I was sure at that point. And so that's not to say I'm you know, so glowingly enthusiastic that there haven't been challenges, but I definitely wanted to help keep the momentum going such that the integral pieces were there and that we can experiment and design things that are maybe a little bit beyond what we need in sort of the same spirit as what we see overseas. Well,
considering that so many of our attendees are designing these bits of equipment, inventing things, we have such incredible people, some of them 14, some of them younger than that, that are geniuses or just really enthusiastic, open to learning. You know, we have a lot of people that know this stuff. And to basically, it's a very it's not hard to say, okay, you know, we know this, let's apply it. Let's apply it to something other than the business environment. Let's apply it to something, as you say, a demonstration ISP, a hacker conference that takes place over a weekend. Let's see what we can do. And I think with that attitude, which it's more prone to what they do over in Holland and Germany, let's unite. Let's work together and see just how far we can push this. Let's be ridiculous about it and see just how quickly we can overcome the challenges. And isn't that what a hacker conference is all about?
Absolutely. And that's the way I've been characterizing it. And I may not know everything about it. I'm learning. I've had a bit of a crash course with some of the state of the art as I've been going and talking and trying to help out with it. But I think that inspiration, what I was seeing and you know, being able to travel, some of the very conferences I went to were things I heard about from Off the Hook and from your travels abroad. And seeing that, you know, I'm not in that industry per se. I don't design these sorts of things, but I understand them enough to be able to say, hey, we could do this and sort of wrangle. All the pieces were there. I wanted to help really get people motivated around it. And I felt that the one thing we should really evolve and build upon at Hope is a very, very strong network, because clearly we're going to have several thousand people there that understand the technology.
Yes.
I believe at the Congress in the winter, they calculated that there were 3.5 or 2.5 devices per every person. That's unique MAC addresses. So people have phones, laptops, you know, you name it, they're bringing them all to the event. So there's
Berlin, yes.
Many devices connecting. And so we want to evolve our network and have really, really awesome stuff and encourage people to bring awesome stuff, bring projects,
right.
Bring servers, bring all kinds of Creative Commons stuff you want to share, art, maybe, you know, a new movie that you're trying to distribute. These are fantastic ways to do it when you have a very, very strong and experimental sort of demonstration network to tap into when you come to the conference.
And the reaction we've gotten so far has been really, really strong and enthusiastic. And I'm looking forward to this. We're going to make history. And if people want to get involved, either as a volunteer, email volunteers@hope.net. If you have a project, projects@hope.net. And of course, if you just want more information or want to register for the conference, www.hope.net has all the information. Again, it's July 13th through 15th of this year.
And speakers at
hope.net. Of course, yeah. I shouldn't forget that, Bernie. You're right. Speakers, we are still open to people who want to submit talk ideas. We've had a really good response so far. A lot of very amazing speakers have submitted ideas. We've accepted a few of them so far, but we have a lot more to go through. But the submission process is still open. So if you have an idea for a talk, speakers@hope.net, then go to the website to see some pointers as to what it is we're looking for and how best to shape your submission.
Oh, well, no, that's actually a very good point to make. But as far as the network goes, I just think it's really important to point out how much of a feat this really is. Many people, even technical, don't realize just how much is actually involved in making this happen. We literally are building an ISP for the weekend. All the routers, wires, everything's all being brought in. We're not even using any of the building's infrastructure at all. Microwaving the connection, and a lot of times we have to run stuff throughout the whole building. It's a literally almost everything that's being used to create that network is being brought in. So it's not there before and it's not there afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely right, .red. And to speak to that, I mean, it's as much as we're trying to be a little bit more coordinated with manufacturers and getting technical sponsorships, it's still going to be a bit of a rodeo. And we certainly, once we get the internal stuff down, we're certainly open to like other experimental ideas and ways to sort of diversify it. And I guess if anyone listening, if you perhaps are working for one of these entities that you think you know, you have the right gear for a particular attribute, we really want the people that make this stuff to shine. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's not going to be some sort of banner project. We want their gear used in just the right place so that we can sort of demonstrate the state of the art and show that people that are enthusiasts and that aren't officially involved can still wrangle and coordinate the gear in an amazing way.
We've really gone through this hour. I do want to give listeners a chance to call in because we do want to hear from you, obviously. 212-209-2900 is our phone number. In the minutes that we have left, please give us a call. Any opinions, thoughts, concerns, that kind of thing, the phone lines are open. 212-209-2900. Rob.
And I also want to tell anyone who's interested or who has ideas to share about things that we could do at Hope, check out talk.hope.net. That's our forum, and a lot of the planning is going on there, and there are some really good ideas being passed around. So to be part of that, join our forum.
It's incredible because if you have an idea, we're going to listen to it. And there aren't many conferences you can say that about. There certainly aren't many radio shows you can say that about, but we're open, and this is how we meet amazing people from around the entire planet. So let's meet some of them now. 212-209-2900. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Yes. Tom.
Tom from the Bronx. Yes. We know your voice well. What's on your mind?
Yeah. I'd like to say that your program tonight is very eye-opening, and I've come to the conclusion where there is Twitter, there's a way.
Oh, I like that. That's good. Where there's Twitter, there's a way. Write that down. Thanks for that. And yes?
Where isn't there Twitter?
That's another good question.
I mean, besides China.
Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yeah, good evening. I want to ask you a question about the Occupy movement. I live in New York City, and what do you think it would take for the Occupy movement to become so solidified and so mobilized and unified that it would actually come up with candidates and a voting bloc party the way the Tea Party was formed? And the reason why I ask is because I think the overall riding umbrella is something under the Occupy movement. It's something that people feel in common, even though the Occupy movement is somewhat different to different people. But the overall big ideas are the same to everyone who is supporting it. So what do you think it would take for the movement to come up with candidates and form a serious party like the Tea Party?
Yeah, I was actually at Zuccotti during one brainstorming session where the people down there were discussing this very thing. And I think the general feeling is that because if you ask 10 people who are protesting at Occupy Wall Street why they're there, you'll get 10 different answers. And trying to attach the whole movement to sort of the political career of one individual is probably not the way to go to keep with anything that makes Occupy what it is.
Right, right. Rob makes a very good point. I think that if any of us actually had the answer to that question, then there actually maybe would all be a solution of some sort. However, one of the ways that the Tea Party did is by piggybacking off another party in the first place. They felt they agreed enough with the Republicans to use their party as a, you know, basically as a leech to.
Yeah, and the big comparison that I've always heard between Occupy and the Tea Party is that the Tea Party, the news kept talking about it until people showed up, and Occupy people kept showing up until the news had to talk about it.
That's really good. That's really good.
So what we have to do is get the Pirate Party out here, then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
I think though that a lot of people in Occupy Wall Street, and it's certainly a movement that does not speak with one voice, don't feel that running candidates is the way to affect change in this country or in any part of the world. So I don't know that a Occupy Wall Street candidate is a thing that could even exist.
Maybe not. Maybe it would have to be something else. But certainly being out there, being vocal, makes a difference. Otherwise, the authorities wouldn't be so concerned and worried about it. Let's... Oh, no, we lost all our phone calls. How'd that happen? 212-209-2900. Look at that. There we go. I'm sorry. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Professor Kleistron.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, could you guys make sure that you check Speakers of Hope? Because one of my friends can be sending. We'd like to bring maybe a Veronica, the newest Veronica, and show it off and do another Pirate Radio 101. And
What is a Veronica?
Veronica is a high-quality, hand-built English to FM transmitter, in our case, ultra-portable.
Okay.
And with significant power. You've seen one before in H2K. We'd like to bring the latest one, but I was also wondering, just real quick, is it possible to do more than one speech?
By speech, you mean, well, first of all, it's not the United Nations. Basically, we have talks and panels and discussions and all kinds of fun things like that. Of course, if you have ideas for more than one talk, we're open to all of them. We treat each one as an individual idea. Just don't wear yourself out.
Manuel, make sure you catch it. We're going to send you, a friend of mine is going to send you an email with our proposal this week to Speakers at Hope. Okay, you're looking for Pirate Radio 101 and maybe something else. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for your call and thanks for the enthusiasm. Speakers@hope.net, that's the address if you have something to submit.
And we'll read your proposal even if you don't call us in advance.
Yeah, we will. We read everything.
All the proposals, yes. Even the terrible ones, of which we get relatively few. But
I've been really amazed this year. There have been some really good ones, some really people that are very notable in the field, but also people who are new. And if you've never spoken before, we're going to listen to you the same as everybody else. And we're willing to give you a shot before an audience. Think about that. New York City, hundreds of people. I mean, yeah, you can be scared about doing that, too. But I think we've all been on stage at some point, and it's kind of scary, right? Anybody want to share what it was like the first time you ever spoke before a crowd?
Well, speaking in public is always a scary thing, especially if you've never done it, especially if there's, you have the filming equipment such where you actually have a hard time seeing the crowd. But it's also a very fun thing to do, and it's also good to give back to the community. And that's how society moves, as everyone builds off of the achievements of others.
It's truly terrifying, though. I've had some interesting experience. I was up speaking once, but you also get amazed at the response you get. It's not the response you'd imagine, and you don't get to say things quite, it doesn't come out exactly how you plan it. It never does, but it's amazing the response and how people are receptive to it and they're interested in what you have
to
say.
It's like being on the radio, but you'd be surprised how comfortable you'll get in front of an audience, and you'll have things to say, really amazing things to say and share, and you become part of the family that way.
And a really important point is that when you're a hacker and speaking in front of people is scary to you, remember you're speaking in front of other hackers. You're speaking in front of our community, people who get these things that you're talking about.
And you'll be making friends for life at the same time. Let's try and squeeze in one more phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. I could think there was an earlier instance of people who would dare to take on the powers of a huge corporation like McDonald's. If you recall, about 10 years ago, Oprah Winfrey was given a civil summons with huge stakes attached to it.
Oprah Winfrey took on McDonald's? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they actually took on her. She made some remark about, well, perhaps we should...
They're equally powerful, I guess.
Yeah, she went over there. It was a civil action, but there were many dollars at stake, and she wasn't the only defendant in this suit.
I don't know if it was the McDonald's or like the Beef Producers Association, but I do remember this case, yeah.
Yeah, so it shows. McDonald's, I think, was one of the principal buyers, and I know they had a lot riding on it. And so it shows what they will take on somebody like that. They have thin skin, or much at stake, or both. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks for that. And I guess that's as good a note as any to end upon. But to read it, what we've been saying over the last hour or so. The Hope Conference is coming along July 13th through 15th of this year. You can register at www.hope.net. You can submit speaker proposals and volunteer to help and come forward with ideas for technology and all kinds of things like that.
And if you're planning on coming to Hope, please tell a friend. This is going to be an event not to miss. So you'll want your whole community there.
Occupy McDonald Land. That's all I want to say.
Thanks. Our address here at the radio show, oth@2600.com. We're out for this week. Stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
yeah. Oh, man, I like that. I really like that. They told me it was Trash 80. That's who's doing this song. It's 8 o'clock, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. Also streaming on the web at WBAI.org. And you can pick up the streaming audio at PCRadioShow.org. And it being March the 14th, 2012, at 8 o'clock, that means it is now time for the personal computer shoe. Ooh, yeah, we got him. We got him. We got him.
And good evening. This is Joe King, and welcome to the Personal Computer Show. On my right, always on my right, is Hank Key, my co-host. And on the left coast, on my left, is David Perry, our other co-host. Is David with us, Stevie?
Of course he is.
I'm right here.
I see you there, David. You're looking much better than usual. Have you been out in the sun?
You lose some weight?
I actually was out in the sun today.
Well, it was a beautiful day. It really
was.
It's
a beautiful day in New York. It's over 70 degrees.
71.
At any rate, this is the Personal Computer Show, and you know that means we're going to talk about personal computers and other things relating to personal computers. Hank, what's new in the news?
Well, you know, yesterday was Tuesday, and it was Microsoft Update Day, and I had all those updates going on 6-7 computers. I had no problems at all.
No problems at all. Gee, I wish I could have said that, because
they're going to have to work harder.
Well, the first thing that happened to me after I got the update, incidentally, it was a very, very important update, because they found a major, major problem in the remote desktop protocol, which a lot of programs use.
Now, wait a minute. How many people use remote desktop?
I find that a lot do. GBridge uses it. Google uses it. Google Talk uses it. Of course, all the different programs like PC Anywhere use it.
So when you're saying RDP,
I'm just talking about
the. You're not talking about the actual function itself. You're saying the architecture.
The underlying architecture of remote desktop protocol is used in a great many programs. And not only did they find a major security breach in it, but they said publicly they expect that within 30 days there are going to be many proof of concepts out there in the wild taking over machines using this technology. So, of course, we all put it in. And what was the first thing I found out? RDP is much, much better than it was, and my iTunes stopped working.
Now, wait a minute. I don't use iTunes, so I don't have that problem.
Well, I uninstalled iTunes, and I reinstalled iTunes, and
what
I did
pain.
This, and I did, and iTunes still didn't work. And then I noticed at the bottom of the error message, there was a button that I never noticed before.
It said, you mean you fell for just click right through and don't bother reading?
Absolutely. But this time it said, click here for more information. So what the hell? I had no information as it was. All I could do is improve. I clicked here for more information, and it brought me right up to a Microsoft site. And the Microsoft site said, we are well aware of the problem you're having with iTunes, and so is Apple, and they have already issued a new release. It's, you know, 0.0453264, whatever it was, a minor release. So I went over there and downloaded it and installed it, and guess what? iTunes still didn't work. Now I was really puzzled, and I didn't know what to do, so I rolled back the system. With Windows, you can roll it back. I rolled it back to last Friday. I know that my iTunes worked on Friday because I downloaded a podcast then. And, of course, that did not settle anything, except it messed up my system, and I still couldn't use iTunes. And then I looked down, and, Hank, I have one of these things called a Sansa Clip. It's an MP3 player.
Okay, you're saying you had a USB device.
It was plugged into the USB because that's the only way you can charge this Sansa thing.
A lot of people don't know what you're talking about when you say Sansa device.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was talking about either.
It's a USB device that you had connected to the system as you brought up the system.
It's an MP3 player.
The brand name of the USB device.
Right.
Well, the Sansa is the manufacturer. It's an MP3 player, and the only way you can charge it is by plugging it into your computer's USB 2 port. Which I did, and I thought about it, and I remembered a long time ago I had a iOmega hard drive plugged into a USB port, and I had all kinds of problems with booting up, And maybe this had something to do with it. And I don't know why I thought of it, but I just unplugged it, put it in my pocket, rebooted the system, and everything worked perfectly. iTunes, everything else. So it wasn't just the problem of the new release of iTunes. It was the problem of the USB device. And the reason I'm telling you the story, folks, is when you see that something doesn't work, and an awful lot of the email we get, something has stopped working, how can we fix it? You got to be aware that anything you do to your computer, anything you plug in or unplug or any change you make can affect something else. Doesn't matter whether you're a power user or a naive user, a brand new user or an expert user. You got to remember everything that you've done. Hank?
I just want to ask you, everything is cool now?
Well, I don't know. I got to tell you why I don't know. Because the way Windows works, as opposed to the way Macintosh works, Windows, everything can affect it. And I'd have to test everything to say it's all cool. With Macintosh, you know they never have a problem, ever.
Well, for the most, what you're saying is, for the most part, based on what you were able to resolve and based on my experience, with the download patch, just do it.
Oh, absolutely do it. This is an important patch.
Now, while I'm saying that, yesterday or today, Sukuna is...
Who's Sukuna?
It's a security outfit that tracks a vulnerability to various pieces of software, hardware, and so on. And they have a policy that when they discover a vulnerability, they notify the publisher or the manufacturer, and they give them 6 months' time to respond to get a fix in. And they have one for Apple, and this is with Safari. And what do you think the vulnerability is with Safari that Apple has not responded to in 6 months' time?
What would that be?
Remote access exploitation.
Now, isn't that strange?
You know, Hank, that there's vastly more unpatched vulnerabilities in Apple's than there
No.
What makes this strange is that the main problem with this current Microsoft patch Tuesday
similar.
Was remote...
Remote access
vulnerability. I wonder if underlying there wasn't something similar in the architecture.
Now, here's my point on this, okay? Now, Sukuna, basically, they don't want to advertise a vulnerability, and what they do is they want to give the manufacturer, the publisher, time to fix it. Is 6 months' time enough, or do you really think they should have given Apple more time to fix it?
I can actually speak to this. It is generally accepted that you go to the manufacturer with a discovered vulnerability in the white hat universe, and you go to Microsoft or Apple or Cisco or whoever has a vulnerability, and they let you know how much time they need to patch it. But generally, it's about 6 months.
In this case, they did not respond at all to Sukuna, and they just felt obligated after 6 months of not getting any response from Apple to say, here's the vulnerability.
Just not really to change the subject, but just a little bit, because a lot of folks don't know who Sukuna is and what they are, and they're a commercial outfit, and they make their money by selling security services to other people. But they also have a free application that you and I can and should and do use, and it's called Sukuna Personal something. Sukuna.com is where you can download it. And what it does is it goes through all of the programs on your hard drive that are installed and lets you know which ones have had reports of problems, which ones have updates.
They check the version numbers of each of the things.
And they give you a list of not only what you should update, but you can just click on a link to update it. It's really a very good program. S-E-C-U-N-I-A, is it, Hank?
There's no I.
S-E-C-U-N-I-A.
Is there an I? Really?
Yeah, Sukuna.
Sukuna.com.
Sukuna.com.
Okay.
Okay.
Hey, by the way, you know, I just want to change the subject a little bit because we're talking about the West Coast. I you know, at some point in time, I've been talking about that. You know, I used to live and work out in the West Coast. And
In the home of the homeless.
I was in Santa Monica.
That was the home of the homeless.
And, I remember building my, you know, I'm by myself, I'm living alone, and while my time away, I bought an Ico FM radio kit, and I put it together, and it worked fine, and and the first station that I was able to...
ICO, E-I-C-O, was this 1962?
No, 1960.
Okay.
Okay, and I built it, and of course you look for the first clear station you get, and it was a Pacifica station, and the performer was Cannonball Adderley. I liked the music, and that's how I got hooked on Pacifica.
And that's how you got hooked on Cannonball Adderley.
And by the way, David, how did you ever get the familiar
station,
with
actually.
Pacifica?
It's funny because we're segueing over to so I can talk about this. I originally a friend of mine loaned me a record in 1969. I was a freshman in high school. And it was by a group called the Fire Sign Theater, and they had a radio show on KPFK. Very soon,
For those here on the right coast,